Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's almost fall, not technically, but it feels like the weather has turned a bit. And so to celebrate that, we've invited Ben Gelber, NBC4 meteorologist, back to the studio today to talk about the weather, what happened this summer, what in the heck happened this summer with the weather, and what might be happening in the fall. Welcome to the show, Ben.
Hi, Ann. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, except for the allergies have kicked in for me, and I've heard that's been happening to a lot of people.
Yeah, probably you and about 90% of the rest of us.
Yeah, so now is that because the weather turned finally or what?
Yeah, I think the weather certainly affects hay fever season. We're in ragweed season every year this time anyway. Typically, our highest pollen count and spore numbers are mid-August to mid-September. And then you throw in the fact that we had a perfect setting for a great, not just ragweed crop, but just pretty much everything crop with the wet, warm weather. We were about a month ahead of schedule as far as temperatures, growing season, way back when in the spring when it used to rain. So everything came up, and now that we can't buy a shower, that is actually conducive to a lot of stuff just kind of floating around in the wind and nothing to really cleanse the air. We had a little bit of rain, of course, Saturday. But so I think everything's just ganged up on us this summer and fall, and for that matter, back to last spring. So we've had a double whammy and probably one of the worst, if not the worst, allergy seasons I can remember since I've been here just anecdotally talking to folks. And I guess in the few spots where they measure this kind of thing, it's been exceptionally high.
You know, we didn't get as much rain as I would thought we would get looking at the sky on Saturday. But last week, it was even a stranger storm, in my opinion. People were sort of in a dither. It looked like a big storm was building up over Columbus. And then it just sort of split off to the north. It went away.
Yeah, and that's the problem. With a dry atmosphere, systems have very little moisture to work with, whereas in the upper Midwest, there was plenty of rain, and that kind of perpetuated the water cycle. Same systems come east, and then they have very little. They essentially run out of gas, so you get the scattershot approach to rain. And we saw, as you mentioned last Tuesday, we had nasty storms north and south of the Outer Belt, for that matter, let alone northern and central and southern sections of Ohio, but nary a drop between the northern and southern outer belts here in Franklin County. Well, some spots obviously did get rain, and as I had to do on Wednesday, go back and look at storm damage in Knox County, where they had a tremendous microburst with winds close to 100 miles an hour. So, it's just luck of the draw as far as rain, although not so lucky for residents in northeastern rural Knox County.
It was strange last week, that day of the big storm, or lack of big storm, lack thereof. Just two doors down from us, we were watching it rain in someone's backyard, but it was dry as a bone in ours.
Sure. I mean, there's going to be a cutoff point to showers, and when they're very small, that cutoff point could be 5 miles away or 5 feet away, and it just depends where the back edge of the cloud is.
What's a microburst again? How does that work?
Microburst is a low-level wind shear event. In other words, it's close to the ground. In this case, usually some dry air entrained in a storm, and then that causes some cooling, and then by force of gravity, cooling because the dry air begins to evaporate the raindrops in the storm, and then the heavier, drier air just collapses or rushes to the ground and then fans out. It can look like on a if you see sometimes we'll actually see these out in the distance. If you have flat terrain, you see a thunderstorm, and it looks like you see the rain curtain, and then it kind of fans out like a shoe or a boot. That's literally like taking a pail of water and dumping it on the sidewalk, and you get the splatter effect. And a microburst, by definition, is up to 2.5 miles wide, so you can have a damage path that's a couple of miles wide and maybe 5 or 10 miles long, as we saw in Knox County. Again, the damage may be scattered, but then in concentrated areas where the winds reach 75 to maybe 100 miles an hour, hurricane force, a lot of damage. And, roofs torn off, trees down, cornfields smushed, and that's the kind of thing we were able to show last week.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Ben Gelber, NBC4 meteorologist. If you want to join the conversation, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post your question or comment there. We will find it somehow. Any surprises for you this summer? Was this what you expected?
Well, it's hard to expect one of the warmest summers on record. Nationally, I believe we were fourth, and records officially start in 1895 for these computations. For some states, not ours, it was the hottest summer on record, defined meteorologically as June, July, and August. Technically, it's still summer astronomically until September 23rd. Mm-hmm. But for these past 3 months, and for that matter, the past 6 months, warmest on record for parts of the Northeast and parts of the South, especially the South Central states, more than the Southeast. And for many other states, you know, top 10. And I believe here in the Buckeye State, we came in just shy of top 10, which is a little surprising, but we didn't really have the core of the heat, and partly because I think the humidity was so high that while it was extraordinarily uncomfortable, the actual air temperatures weren't soaring past 100 degrees as they did, say, in the dry summer of 1999. Because of all that rain and then vegetation or vegetative cover early in the season, you know, the humidity, while it was more uncomfortable, actually limited how high the temperature would get because we either had more cloud cover or sunshine resulted in evaporating moisture instead of heating the surface. So we had, well, we had maybe two dozen days of 90-degree heat. We had almost the same amount of days in the upper 80s. So if it had been just a little drier, we might have had 40 days of 90-degree heat, which is one of our classic measures. But either way, you know, exceptionally hot.
It feels like, obviously, the humidity feels like it's gone away.
Yeah, we've, like you said, we turned the corner. And that in that sense, not only is it cooler, but we have, you know, the jet stream has shifted farther south. So suddenly we're getting cooler Canadian air masses penetrating and knocking down the Bermuda High, which was very strong and persistent, which does happen now and then. And that's the kind of summer we had. It was just extremely persistent this summer. And then once it dried out, especially east of the Appalachians, even more so than here, you know, it became a very hot, classically hot, dry summer in the mold of the 1930s, 1950s, and a couple of summers back in the 90s. As you said, we put a dent in that ridge. It's kind of been suppressed, and that's seasonal. That's mm-hmm. what you would expect. So we're getting refreshing fall air masses. Today will be a warm day in the low 80s, but many days we've had in the very comfortable 70s, nights in the 40s and 50s, and that's just about seasonal.
You know, it seems like whenever there's extended periods of cold, the people who disagree with the idea of global warming say, see, it's not warming. And then when there are periods of extreme heat or high levels of heat or whatever, like we've had this summer, people say, hey, look at global warming. The relative temperature doesn't have a lot to do with the theory of global warming, does it, Ben?
Nope, means absolutely nothing. I mean, these are singular events, and that weather evens out. You know, and so to whichever side of the coin you look at, to latch on to the historically snowy winter or our historic hot summer, all of which have occurred in the past 6 months, you know, is ludicrous because you completely contradict. You can't hold diametrically opposed views if you are just going to be objective and look at the data. But we're looking at the wrong data if you're forming an opinion based on one winter, one summer, or even a cluster of winters or summers or springs or falls or mm-hmm. drought. You know, the whole idea of global warming or climate change is you must look at periods of decades and centuries and millennia, to draw judgments. And of course, as we've talked about in past programs, mm-hmm. you can find natural cycles on the level of thousands of years, even aside from the glacial cycles that are embedded in our climate rhythm. The more difficult question is filtering out how much of the current warming trend that we have been in the past half century, how much, you know, is related to human activity versus natural cycles. And it's a very thorny and controversial question.
Exactly. 614-292-8513. If you want to talk to Ben Gelber, NBC4's meteorologist, he's here waiting for your questions and comments. Everybody always has a lot when it comes to the weather in Ohio, because if you wait 5 minutes, well, you know the rest of that sentence. Everyone's on hurricane watch these days. I mean, I grew up never thinking about hurricanes growing up in Michigan, but now we think about them in the Midwest.
Sure.
Ever since Ike.
Yeah, I think Ike changed our perspective. That was a once in 100-year, if not 500-year event, where the remnant tropical system, and by then it was Tropical Depression Ike, which made landfall on this day, by the way, in 2008 in Galveston Bay, Texas, and then trucked north. And many a storm has done that with, you know, minimal impact, some rain, some wind. Even Katrina, which I had almost forgotten when I did the anniversary piece, had an impact on central Ohio. We had 3 to 6 inches of rain around the region and some gusty winds and a record low August barometric pressure on the 31st. But that's a more typical development. But it was just the perfect storm, our version of it, you know, similar to the 1991 hurricane off the East Coast, which is the convergence of two storms, Grace and another storm that turned into a monster.
That's right.
All right, and which was popularized in movie and book form. Well, we had our perfect storm with Ike on September 14th of 2008 because the remnants came up the Ohio River Valley, but then happened to get underneath the jet stream, which in of itself wouldn't guarantee what we had. But it also happened during the heat of the day when the temperature was 90 degrees, the atmosphere was thoroughly mixed, and at a level of, we'll say, a mile and a half above the surface, we had winds upwards of 80 miles per hour. And, you know, say same scenario happens at night, maybe the atmosphere, you know, things don't link up. But because we had thermals and strong heating that we were able to, you know, vertical the up and down currents in the atmosphere linked up with this very high wind just above the surface. And that came mixing down, you know, for the duration of the storm moving through the state, which was probably a good 4 hours of hurricane force winds. And that's unprecedented for a tropical system, not unprecedented for a windstorm, but it was a certainly unique set of events.
And it was so unusual to us because it came in those ripples, or those waves, I should say.
Sure. It, you know, again, it was, you know, pulsing because you had these eddies coming down, again, mixing down these incredibly strong winds, which were not entirely Ike's winds. You know, Ike, as a tropical depression, was packing maybe 30-mile-per-hour winds.
Oh, okay.
So you might expect, as we saw to our south and west earlier in the day when we didn't have this unusual combination of events, you know, more traditional 20, 30, 40-mile-per-hour winds coming up the Mississippi Valley, and then the storm made a bit of a right turn. But then it came under the jet stream, and now you had the linkage between the strong surface winds, which were only half the speed, of course, and which is typical. Winds are not nearly as strong at the surface as they are aloft. But once things connected, now you are drawing on this very well-mixed atmosphere and pulling down what we call transfer of momentum, very strong winds from above, not too far above the surface. And it just kept blowing and blowing like a wind machine relentlessly till the surface low moved up 71 into northeast Ohio.
We're going to have to take a quick break. My guest is Ben Gelber, NBC4 meteorologist. Get those questions and comments ready. We will take them, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
In commercial radio, in-depth means a minute 30. On much of public radio, you can hear stories stretched to 6 or 7 minutes. On Talk of the Nation, we're not talking in-depth until we've hit the half-hour mark. I'm Neil Cownan. Take your time with the discussion on Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And in the week ahead on Talk of the Nation, the state of the Gulf after the oil spill, and a discussion about the damage that was and was not done. Plus, the regular Wednesday visit from Political Junkie, all that and more in the week ahead on Talk of the Nation. On to WOSU 820, NPR News. And sunshine in the forecast for today, a high of 85 degrees. Clear skies tonight and a low of 52. Sunny tomorrow and a high of 78. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820, NPR News.
Here come the Ben Gelber. He's a weather forecaster. His hair is a disaster. Gotta love him for that. News for weather guy. Mac, get a forecast high. Anybody want the deal? Gonna mess with the seal.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We like that song about Ben Gelber. It's on YouTube. Ben, can you remind us about the source of that?
Yeah, everybody always asks me, when did this come out? And Valentine's Day 1995 is when the music video debuted, which is essentially about a week after the song debuted. Morning Zoo, Dave Kalin and company created a great song. A good trivia question is, can you name the original song, which you hear maybe once in a great while? And I'll let you think about that. Okay. We'll come back to that. They put the lyrics together. The song came out. It had to have been early February of 1995. And then we kind of huddled together kind of as a station. Of course, first I'm mortified, as we all are, when we hear songs right. about ourselves. That's a normal reaction. You just want to hide in a corner and hang out maybe or go to the tropics for a month and come back and hopefully things have gone away. But couldn't do that because it was February ratings and the weather was important. Some of the brighter minds at the station when it comes to creativity, many of them are still in the business doing a great job with various media companies locally because we all stay in touch. I said, why don't we make a music video, which was kind of unheard of. And this was, in the earlier days, something that was not an automatic thought. But they said I would have to star in it. And I thought, no, this just reinforces something that is going to be really difficult to deal with. But they, no, you have to do this. You have to do this. You're going to have fun. And they finally convinced me to go ahead and give it a shot. And they pretty much gave me creative control, which, at least gave me the feeling that, all right, I can parody myself in a way that I would like to do it. I said, we'll kind of play off the science end of things, kind of if not the Mr. Wizard of old days, but maybe Bill Nye the Science Guy and that kind of stuff.
The geeky part.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
in a good way.
In a good way. And which have now, in sitcom fashion with Big Bang Theory, being geeky is hip. So things have finally come around my way. So we went ahead and, we just took, line by line, and they asked me, what did I want to do? And I had suggestions, and in some cases our promotions folks had thoughts. And then we literally went from place to place to place. Be it our studio or the barbershop or wherever, just getting random shots in some kind of order. And we threw this thing together. I think our first meeting was in the middle of the week, or we had it together within several days, or at least fully shot, and then edited and on the air the beginning of the following week. So, but we kind of made it up as we went. The song, of course, is "I'm a Hot Stepper." I might have a word or two wrong there, but Here Comes the Hot Stepper, something like that. And the artist was Ima Kamosi. So that's the answer to the trivia question. That's the original song, which Dave Kalin and company did such a terrific job with the lyrics. And they said, how memorable be become. More importantly, the proceeds went to a very good cause from video at the time. And as you said, now it's on YouTube. As of about a year ago.
For all of the world to treasure, and we'll put a link to that on our website at wosu.org/offside so you can enjoy it later. We'll play a little bit more of it later as well. 614-292-8513 if you'd like to speak with Ben Gelber. And John, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Ben, I enjoy your forecasting. And I just noticed recently that these hurricanes that were coming out of Africa all of a sudden in the last couple of days have been named cyclones. So have the national forecaster misnamed them before, or what's the deal with that? Why has the name changed now from hurricane to cyclones?
Yeah, not really sure on that, and thanks for your comments and question. Cyclone is really the all-encompassing, if we go back a little bit, generic term for low pressure. Cyclone is the name for hurricanes in the Bay of Bengal, for example, over in storms that approach India, Pakistan. But typically we, and for centuries, have called storms in the Atlantic Basin and the Eastern Pacific hurricanes. And of course, in the Western Pacific Basin, typhoons, all the same storm. So I'm not really sure, but maybe it's just trendy to talk about tropical cyclones, which is completely correct. Uh-huh. But technically, and again, not that there's anything wrong with that, as they say, but we should be calling Atlantic storms hurricanes once they reach the minimum criteria of 74 miles per hour. And we have a string of them, as you mentioned. Igor, Ann and I were just talking about, and last night became a Category 4, borderline 5 at 150 miles per hour. And there's another storm behind it, I believe Julie, but that is taking shape off the coast of Africa, and there are other areas of disturbed weather. But this is peak season. Early to mid-September is when the combination of warm water and weaker winds aloft. So hurricane season, even a slow starting one like this one, things seem to really get rolling sometimes at this time of year.
One more quick question. When they come off Africa, they seem to be right by the equator. Is that what is happening because of the north versus the south?
Well,
I guess winds or spinning or whatever happens.
Yeah, you have to, as you said, you have to have spin. And at the equator, we don't have that right at the equator. So storms can't really get organized until they're usually 5 or 7 degrees latitude away from the equator. So you can start to tap into the, you know, both the Coriolis effect and get the rotational component needed to get these storms going. They do begin as clusters of storms that form over Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, which is, you know, right near the equator where you get the strong convection, the upward motion and the buildup of storms. And then these waves kind of drift off the coast of Africa. Now, only 10 to maybe 20% will develop into a tropical depression. But for that to happen, the wave itself needs to be to develop some rotation to what starts as a cluster of storms now moving over the open waters of the Atlantic, a good 5 to 7 degrees, in this case, north of the equator.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks for your questions.
Thanks, John. 614-292-8513. We had another caller earlier who wanted to. Okay, I can't see that question now. We'll have to move that back on our studio chat because I can't see the question. Anyways, we have some questions from Facebook and email from Barbara on Facebook. Please ask Ben how they managed to miss Ike doing so much damage. On that day, there was a wind advisory. I had no electricity for 6 days. So how do you predict that kind of thing?
Well, and that's the problem. You really can't. The expectation was for strong winds, and it did go beyond a wind advisory to a high wind warning before the storm arrived. But I'm not sure exactly when the National Weather Service issued the high wind warning, whether it was late Sunday morning, which would probably be after the Sunday morning newscast. It's not something you're looking for. And as meteorologists who've never seen such an event, none of us has ever seen something like this at our latitude, if any latitude, you simply are not looking for hurricane force winds in Ohio from a tropical depression. So that's problem number one. Now, back, this was on a Sunday, September 14th. The night of September 13th, I did say that we run the risk of and would expect damaging winds in Ohio in my 6 and 11 o'clock weathercast. Now, when I said and my expectation then was with tropical systems, the remnants, you typically get squall lines, which tap into potentially strong winds. You can get even occasionally a spin-up tornado. You're more apt to get a line of damaging winds. So I expected, and so it was not completely unpredicted. I was very clear on the air that we could have pockets of damaging winds. Mm-hmm. But neither I nor anyone else expected widespread damaging winds. We thought maybe any line of showers or any frontal boundary that spun off the remnants of the storm, as that pushed through, you could get 40, 50, 60, 70 mile per hour winds, but for a short time, not for 4 hours.
And there was no rain with it either.
And that's the other quirk. I mean, there wasn't a drop of rain. Mm-hmm. We might have had some mist.
It was nice out.
On the backside of the storm. We would have been better off if there was rain because that would have cut off that connection between the – we would have initially had the strong winds and then – just like with a thunderstorm, and that's what we were expecting, and that part was expected, strong or even damaging winds on the front end of the storm. But then things would settle down as the rain, as that momentum transferred down. But in absence of rain, we just had this continuous loop of high winds, and it was just awful, unbelievable.
Thanks to Barbara on Facebook. If you want to, you can go to Facebook, All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. or go to the telephone, 614-292-8513. We have a caller question from earlier, asks, how many times did we make a record high this summer? Which year did we hit the most record highs?
Boy, I don't have the record books in front of me. Mm-hmm. I'd have to pull out the charts. But I don't know that we had any record highs because, again, we mentioned the higher humidity. So we constantly peaked in the 90 to 93 degree range, which is not record territory because most records are 96 to, in some cases, we've been as high as 106. And then, oddly enough, this month, September, we had our hottest day of the summer when it hit 94. So no record highs, and that probably accounts for the fact that we, you know, we're only flirting with top 10 highest hottest summers. And yet it was just – it just seemed to be relentless because it was. But we were topping out most days in the low 90s. We might have had a record high somewhere in the spring. You know, we had I believe the second warmest April on record. But, yeah, in terms of daily records, those were not being broken. We were staying within certain boundaries. But, you know, day in and day out, it was 88 to 93 with very little cooling. Plus, the nights were abnormally warm, and that's a function of high dew point. And I believe this would be the fifth most humid summer based on dew point, which is a true measure of the amount of moisture in the air. And I think for Cincinnati, it was the tied for the most muggiest summer on record. Again, summer being defined as June through August.
Back to hurricanes. Does it feel like there's a lot more interest in hurricanes since Ike, since Katrina?
I think not so much since Ike because, again, we had a windstorm, but not, you know, it wasn't a classic hurricane. It just happened to be the byproduct of a tropical depression, former hurricane. But I think that happened in 2004 and 5 when we had, you know, culminating 2005 with the record 28 named storms. And, of course, 2004 we had Charlie and a number of storms that ravaged – three or four storms that ravaged Florida. So we had those back-to-back years. That's what really ramped up interest and concern and after the horrible damage and destructive nature of the storms. And then we had exceptionally powerful storms in 2005 and not just Katrina, which was a Cat 5, but also Rita and Wilma,
right,
which came in September – and into October, and those had set records for or near records for intensity or fastest deepening storm in 24 hours. And that was a byproduct of the exceptionally warm, historically warm Gulf waters, which were around 90 degrees, and that's the fuel. So the assumption was, boy, we're really going to have it now. And then now we've kind of gone through 06, 07, 08, 09, 2010 with normal or below normal seasons, or even above normal seasons, but with very few landfalling storms. So some of the dire predictions, you know, after 04, 05, just like one hot summer doesn't beget, you know, complete radical change. The assumption was now we're going to get hammered every year, and of course that hasn't been the case. It's all part of that natural cycle. But we do pay attention to any changes in water temperatures, and that is a significant climate question and a very valid one. You know, an upward trend of water temperatures, record or near record, you know, is indicative of a warming trend, be it global warming associated with natural activity or human activity.
614-292-8513. And William, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Again, I appreciate Ben's work on NBC4. And I had a question related to a recent poll that kind of showed that most people's ideas of global warming or climate change have to do with their or their information they get is from their local personality. You know, and that personality doesn't necessarily have to be a meteorologist. And I just wondered on Ben's kind of ideas or thoughts on how maybe some of his colleagues, not in Columbus necessarily, but how they, you know, if you have a cold day, for instance, they may say, well, it's so much for global warming. And how that affects, you know, the larger perspective of people's opinions on the difference between global warming and climate and weather.
I have a feeling you don't do that, Ben.
No, I have to. I mean, and I give talks on the subject in schools and students of all ages all the time. And my take on it as a meteorologist, and I have a master's in meteorology, so I'm, you know, we joked, I'm weather geek every which way, but my responsibility as a meteorologist is to play science journalist, and a science journalist, you know, as with any journalist, it's not about taking a particular, you don't advocate for a particular position, even if you have certain inclinations, but you put the best information forward to allow for proper critical thinking. Now, there isn't a whole lot you can do in a very short segment, unlike when you talk in the classroom, and I can discuss the history of global warming, climate change debates. I did an op-ed piece for the New York Times last November on the global warming debate in colonial times, which had some very interesting similarities. You know, a debate that many folks, including myself, until I researched it, didn't realize was going on hot and heavy during the days of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, with lots of back and forth that and vitriol and things like that. It was kind of actually humorous to look back at that, put things in perspective that, you know, we've seen it all before, at least from a political standpoint. But I think most folks, or many folks I talk to, derive their opinions on climate change, global warming from, you know, what they hear, you know, on talk radio or maybe other newspaper columnists. You know, all folks who are not scientists or virtually in all cases, or who may not have a good handle on the science. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've been, you know, driving the car, listening on the radio or even watching a program where I hear statements being made about climate change. And I just about go through the roof because I keep thinking, why not have a science person there? Because some of this stuff is just patently, either if not false or inaccurate, you know, cherry picking of data. And that's the biggest problem. You know, I think that this is a very complex question. There are good arguments could be made in favor of both global warming in terms of human activity and also prevalence of natural cycles. And I'm a firm believer that we have, you know, an overlap here. And I just think that's perfectly logical. And I think that's where mainstream scientists, by and large, are. Now, there is an interesting schism between climatologists, you know, those who study long-term climate, who are meteorologists, and television meteorologists. And this has been shown in some recent a magazine article in the American Meteorological Society Bulletin, some polling which shows a split that – and I can't remember the exact numbers, but roughly 90% of those who identify themselves as climatologists invariably in an academic setting believe global warming is primarily human activity, whereas only 50 or 60% of television meteorologists, you know, hold that view. And there are some, I'm sure, some of my colleagues out there who have made that abundantly clear that they're the differences they have with certain views. I know I certainly read their views in other blogs and newspapers. And if they're blogging it, you know, that's like it being on TV these days. Right. So, yeah, I mean, that stuff's out there. Again, I don't do that in terms of taking a view, but I do make clear, you know, what's good science and what's bad science. I think that's the least I can do. And hopefully folks can, you know, arrive. And there's a great deal of uncertainty in this debate. And I think people who sound very certain, that's when I get skeptical because I know all the variables and I know that there are many variables we can't really have a handle on.
Okay, that is all the time we have for Ben Gelber today. Ben, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Ann.
That's Ben Gelber, NBC4 meteorologist. Hope he'll come back soon, maybe when the weather changes again.
I'll be back.
All
right. I'll be back.
I'll be back. And we'll be back with All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're going to speak with the biographer of the man behind the nose, Larry Bozo Harmon. The fellow we'll be talking with, Thomas Scott McKenzie, wrote the book. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Developed by WOSU Public Media and the Columbus Metropolitan Library, ColumbusNeighborhoods.org features over 30 neighborhoods in and around Columbus and allows users to tell their own stories, post their own photos and video, and contribute to the collective story of Columbus. To be a part of this multimedia public engagement project or to learn more, visit ColumbusNeighborhoods.org.
And you're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher today. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, we will have Hour 2 of All Sides, and we'll discuss the latest in-state news with a State House reporter panel. We'll also preview the upcoming governor's debate, which is Tuesday night at 8 o'clock. And remember, you can hear that debate tomorrow night right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. And taking a look at the weather forecast, it's currently 71 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:40 this morning. Sunshine today, a high of 85. Clear skies tonight, a low of 52 degrees. Sunny for tomorrow and a high of 78 degrees. And in public radio, listener feedback is very important. We'd like to hear your thoughts on the conversations we've been having across the radio and web. NPR is partnering with WOSU to create an online audience advisory panel, and we're looking for your help. Go to WOSU.org/survey, and there you can sign up and send us your thoughts. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. When I heard there was a new book out about Bozo the Clown, the man behind the nose, Larry Bozo Harmon, I expected it to be another gratuitous chronology of a show person's life, and I was wrong. The book is made up of a lively series of stories by Harmon, about Harmon, with the help of Thomas Scott McKenzie. And Thomas Scott McKenzie is with us today to talk about the book and Harmon. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I was surprised that it wasn't that chronological rundown, that he was born this day of parents, you know, such and such parents, and in this place, and how that affected him. It was a lot of lively stories about his life.
That's right. We didn't want to do a sort of, you know, if you pardon the phrase, a kind of boring historical biography of somebody that had every meal that he ever ate and every movie he ever saw. Because when you were with Larry in his presence, it was just this kind of machine gun of stories, of laughs, and of great tales. And so we really approached the book as kind of like, you know, tales at your Grandpa Bozo's knee, more so than a all-encompassing biography.
Was it, it seems like, well, tell me how you wrote it, because, of course, Larry Harmon is, he died in 2008. And is this something you started working on a while ago? Because the voice is so strong.
Yeah, we worked with this. I worked with Larry for about a year to about a year and a half before he passed away. And he was very, very involved. A lot of times you'll run into these instances where there's a celebrity memoir and the celebrity spends like one afternoon on the book, and then the co-author or the ghostwriter just goes away and kind of does his thing. And I've been joking around about how that's how you end up with situations like where Charles Barkley said he was misquoted in his own book. And in Larry's case, he was very, very involved and, you know, was very, very detailed in going over the pages and everything. So we worked very closely on this book to try to capture his voice and his energy.
So what did you do?
Well, I live here in Columbus, but I would go to Hollywood frequently to meet with Larry. And then we also spoke on the phone, you know, multiple times a week. And he would just tell stories and tell stories and tell stories. And, you know, my job as a co-author is to write the book that a celebrity would want to write if they were a writer. And, you know, so my job is to try to capture his voice. And then he would tweak things and he would say, you know, I wouldn't use this word, or, you know, this other image was more important to me at that time. You know, he might say, you know, I felt I was afraid in this adventure, but what really stands out to me was the smell of the area or something like that. So it was a matter of capturing his kind of sensory experiences.
It is very sensory. It makes it very, very interesting because he had an amazing life besides being Bozo the Clown. He had a lot of amazing coincidences. It was a lot of meetings. Al Jolson, for one. Tell us about that.
Well, that was a really pivotal moment in his life because Al Jolson was his childhood hero, and one of his earliest memories was of being fascinated by the movie The Jazz Singer, and he was really just kind of engrossed by the scene where Al Jolson puts the makeup on. And of course, now by today's standards, we know that, you know, performing that manner isn't really in good taste, but at the time, you know, a lot of performers did that with using the makeup and things like that. And the ability of Jolson to put this makeup on and to become almost another person really kind of planted a seed in Larry that would become much, much more clear years later when he's performing as Bozo. But he was just really fascinated with Jolson and then ultimately met Al Jolson when he was in the service. And Jolson gave him some career advice that ultimately set him on the path to becoming the world's most famous clown.
He another big influence was marching band. He worked. You got to tell the story about how he tried out and became the first freshman drum major for this really important high school band in Cleveland ever, and he did it with a cast on his foot.
That's right. Larry Harmon was an internal optimist, and he always believed that there was a way. And I've been saying that, you know, he wasn't naive or unrealistic about life's challenges. It's just that he kind of viewed it almost like a puzzle. You know, if I've run into an obstacle this way, there's another direction I can take, or there's another strategy that I can take. And so he just simply refused to take no for an answer. And leading up to trying out for being the drum major of his high school band, he went to a band camp to try to learn the skills that he would need. And he broke his foot, and he had a cast on his foot, and they told him, you know, there's no way, you're not going to do it. And he said, well, I'll hobble out there, I'll do the best that I can, I'll put my heart and soul into my performance, and hopefully my energy and my personality and my showmanship will help overcome the more mechanical limitations that this cast is putting on me. And it ultimately worked.
My guest is Scott McKenzie, biographer of Larry Harmon, Bozo the Clown, Larry Harmon. The name of the book is The Man Behind the Nose, Larry Bozo Harmon. Assassins, astronauts, cannibals, and other stupendous tales, but they're all true.
Right. I mean, it was amazing because he would pull out these photographs of, you know, being with native tribesmen in New Guinea, or there's video of him floating in zero gravity in these planes that were called vomit comets. There's video of him going on deep sea diving training things. And we put a lot of that into the book. We're really proud of visually the way the book looks. But yeah, it just reached a point to where, you know, it seemed like no tale was too tall.
Right. Well, you start the book out with that quote Remembering a man's stories makes him immortal. It's from Daniel Wallace, Big Fish, a novel of mythic proportions.
That's right.
And it was very apropos. Speaking of the visual layout of the book, it's very important. It's one of the most amazingly laid out books I've ever seen, considering there's so much substance to it. There really is substance. You're not just throwing in a lot of this the borders and a lot of the circus-like atmosphere of the book to make up for a lack of substance.
Right. You know, we really worked very hard on the visual appearance of the book for a couple of reasons. First of all, you know, we just simply wanted to give people value for their money. You know, as writers, we often, it's kind of a parlor game that we complain that people aren't buying books, but we never stop to think about the fact that our books are made the same way they were made 300 years ago. And we wanted to do something that wasn't just simply black words on white paper, and that was it. We also wanted to do justice to the rich visual history of Larry Harmon and Bozo the Clown. You know, with those kinds of tales and those kinds of stories, it just didn't feel right to do a book that was just nothing but text. And then also, it was very important to Larry to try to engage younger readers and even in a certain degree educate them. And so, you know, there are things in the book, there are little clip art images that are scattered around that kind of will take the reader off into another way of thinking. Or if somebody doesn't know what KP duty is in the military, mm-hmm. you know, there's a picture there that kind of gives you an idea. And so, you know, we hoped that the book would be more interactive than just, once again, black words on white paper.
If you want to talk with Scott McKenzie, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We have a few minutes, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Another amazing meeting was right after Larry decided to franchise the Bozo name, the Bozo story. And one of his first, or was it his first, recruit was Willard Scott, of all people.
Yeah, he wasn't the first.
Okay.
But certainly, you know, through Willard's work on the Today Show, he's one of the most well-known people ever to portray Bozo. And, you know, Larry's idea was to have, at each local television market, to have their own Bozo show. So there were actually over 200 men who performed as the character. And which is really interesting because people will argue with you. They'll say, no,
right.
My Bozo was the only Bozo, or mine was the best.
Well, I was thinking, how could he be from Cleveland? He was from Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Exactly. You know, Larry joked that he was the first person ever to figure out how to clone a clown. And so he trained all these men to portray the character, and Willard Scott was one of them. And what's really interesting about that story in the book is that Willard actually spent his honeymoon learning how to be Bozo, which certainly speaks well to his dedication and to the kindness of his wife.
Yeah. Well, in some ways, it was Willard Scott's big break.
Yeah, Willard had been he wasn't discovered.
No.
He had done some television work in the D.C. area and was working on at a news station there. You know, Willard in his own books has talked about his lifelong love of broadcasting, which started, I believe he actually started going into a station when he was like 8 or 9,
mm-hmm.
just to kind of hang out. But it was certainly one of his big breaks. There's no doubt about that.
And Larry was very good at recognizing almost immediately that this guy had some talent.
Yeah. And you know, not just that, but Larry was also very rigorous about who could portray Bozo. He was very protective of the character, and he was very concerned with the character's legacy. And he knew that with this cloning clowns kind of thing, you ran the risk of somebody, you know, doing something that would be out of character. So he was very, very selective, and okay. You know, Willard was one of the best examples of that.
Yeah, I mean, the key to his success, clearly, beyond his amazing showmanship, was his understanding the value of a franchise of Bozo the Clown. He was intrinsically a great businessman.
Right. I mean, that's one of the interesting things about The Man Behind the Nose is that it's not just the story of a clown, but this businessman who harnessed the power of that clown. A lot of people don't realize that Larry Harmon also purchased the rights to the Laurel and Hardy characters in the early 60s. He ran an animation studio. He produced movies. So, you know, he was an all-around businessman, as well as being somebody who looked good in size 83 AAA shoes.
One of the first chapters is his intense desire to become the drum major for that band. And it's very interesting. Obviously, music played a huge influence. But when I was reading about that, it like a light bulb went off in my head as far as the influence of the whole drum major routine on Bozo the Clown.
That's right. I mean, there's definitely a showmanship aspect to the drum major that the character has, a way of walking, a way of almost prancing, if you will. And then the other interesting thing that about being a drum major that fascinated Larry so much was that it wasn't just a showmanship position, but it was also a leadership position. And that was something that was very important to Larry and that he wanted to challenge himself and do in his own life was, you know, he wanted to lead people and inspire people. And he clearly did that with the Bozo organization over the decades.
What about his personal life?
Well, you know, Larry was with his wife, Susan, for 30 years, you know, who was with him. She, you know, found him the morning that he had passed away. And they spent every single moment together. They worked together at the organization. You know, they were together all the time. And Susan worked very closely with us on completing the book after Larry's passing. And she's been doing a lot of the media with us as well.
How far along were you with the book before Larry passed?
Well, what you have, you know, between the covers is pretty much a finished product of what we had worked on with Larry. But, you know, there were certainly stories that we never got to. You know, if Larry hadn't passed away, I mean, the book might have been twice as long as it is.
Okay.
So the pages that are there were really quite complete, and we tied up some loose ends with Susan Harmon's involvement after he passed away. But, you know, he could have kept talking and talking and talking for years afterwards had he not passed away, unfortunately.
He was something of a visionary on many levels as a businessman, as you know, understanding the franchise for something like Bozo the Clown and also with space exploration. He was a big believer in that, and something he talked about a lot during his incarnation is Commander Comet, even though they warned him to stop doing that, stop putting false hopes into people's minds.
Right. Larry was, as I said earlier, he was just an eternal optimist, and he had this television show in the early 50s called Commander Comet. And he would go on there, and he would talk about someday we're going to go to the moon, and someday we're going to travel in spaceships, and we're going to travel at these incredible speeds. And he wasn't a scientist. I mean, he didn't really have any true basis for knowing this stuff. He just believed that man would be able to achieve these things. And so, you know, at one point, his station manager kind of calls him on the carpet and kind of says, you know, do you know that, is that really a fact? And Larry says something to the effect of, it's a fact, it's just not a fact yet. And, you know, it was just his belief in what mankind, and particularly he was so proud of America and so, you know, happy to be a part of this country. He really believed that we could do anything we wanted.
Alan, you're on the air. We only have a few seconds, so give us your question or comment very quickly. Thanks for joining the show.
Quick, I'm 65 now. When I was a kid in the 50s, we had a Bozo the Clown record that it also had a book, and it would go page and then go blah, 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 and you'd turn the page.
Mm-hmm.
Is this, I mean, did he have that or what?
Was that Larry?
The character was actually created by Capitol Records in the late 40s. For a series of children's books, just like you're talking about, that had a record and had a book that you could read along with it. So it was a Capitol property for a few years. By the mid-50s, Capitol's interest had kind of waned, and Larry took over ownership of the character. And then he's the one that really spearheaded the television empire, you know, as we now know of Bozo. Larry produced some records and some books as well. So it's possible that what you had was either the original Capitol version, and typically you would see that as Bozo the Capitol Clown, or it could have been one of Larry's products, which would typically be designated as Bozo the World's Most Famous Clown.
Okay, Alan, thanks for your call. Sorry, we have run out of time. Scott McKenzie, a biographer of Larry Harmon, is Bozo the Clown, or the man behind Bozo the Clown. The name of the book is The Man Behind the Nose, Larry Bozo Harmon. Assassins, astronauts, cannibals, and other stupendous tales. Scott, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Appreciate it. That's all the time we have for this All Sides. It's been All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.